Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. We have four bills that are set for a public hearing and possible work session, plus one work session. It does look like we have the paperwork necessary for the work session bill, House Bill 3277A, so we do plan on having a work session on that today. But what I'd like to do is go ahead and get started with our public hearings. I see Representative Williamson is here, and I know that she has other duties, just like everyone else in the building. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3467A. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3467A mandates that websites that post mugshots must remove them and all accompanying information when they receive a request in writing from a person who has been acquitted or where charges have been dismissed, or if the crime was reduced to a violation, without charging the requesting party a fee for the removal. A party failing to remove the photograph and other information related to the arrest after being formally requested to do so commits an unlawful practice under ORS 646608.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, the west side of Portland. I am pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 3467. I want to give you a little background on mugshots, for those of you who may or may not be familiar with them. Currently, when a person is arrested, their booking photograph or mugshot is, and personal information is taken by the arresting agency, and it can be posted by that agency to the web. And what happens now is that other private websites will download that information and put it up on their own websites. And these are proprietary websites. If a person is found not guilty or that charges are dropped, it's very, very difficult to get these proprietary websites to remove your mugshot without paying extraordinary fees. So the purpose of this bill is to help people be able to clean up their cyber image and manage their photos on these websites. So this bill, House Bill 3467, makes it a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act to charge money for removing booking information and photographs of a person who was not charged after arrest, was acquitted, whose charges were reduced to a violation, or after conviction, the conviction was expunged or set aside by the court. The photo and the information must be removed within 30 days of the website owner receiving written notice that one of the above conditions was met. So I want to tell you two quick stories. When this bill was first introduced, the Oregonian ran a story on it, and I was walking in the hallway outside of the House chamber, and a man who was here on a different issue, a business owner in Portland, pulled me aside and said, I want to thank you for introducing that bill. My son was arrested. He made a mistake in high school. The charges were dropped. I believe it was a minor in possession charge, and his website or his mugshot is up on websites, and they've charged, three different websites have charged him to take his son's photos down. It's still out there, and he's applying for colleges right now, and every admissions officer that has received his application has seen his mugshot on the web. So he was very concerned about that and thought, you know, I know my son made a mistake, but this is really impacting his ability to apply for colleges. And just the other day, I got an email from a constituent, I believe, of Senator Dingfelder's, who says that she's a licensed clinical social worker in Portland and had a daughter who unfortunately was arrested at 18 for a misdemeanor charge that was dropped to a violation after community service. She's very interested in this bill, not only for my daughter, for many people whom I work with who are in similar situations. I'm acutely aware of the problems arising from the ability of these websites to obtain her daughter's picture. And in one internet search, she counted 20 websites. So she goes on to talk about the impact on her daughter's life of her mugshot being so readily available. So that's the reason I sponsored this bill. It's a good bill, and I hope you pass it out today. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have who with us?
Ryan. My name is Ryan Anfuso. I'm a criminal defense attorney, Chairman Pozanski, members of the committee. I came to be involved in this issue. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Portland. I represent a number of clients who confront this issue, and basically it became a difficult situation to advise clients about. I'd have people who'd come into my office and say, you know, my picture is suddenly all over the internet. And the only way to really advise them on how to remedy this situation, regardless of whether or not these charges ultimately were no complainant by the district attorney's office or the charges were dismissed or if they were in fact guilty, went through some kind of a diversion program, after the charges were dismissed, the problem is the only way to really get rid of these images and the only way to advise them to do that would be to tell them to pay whatever fee these websites are charging. And the reality is I have clients who have done this, and they pay $100 to the first website that might have it up, and then they'll find that it just sort of tendrils out. They'll pay the $100, and then they'll find themselves on four other websites, and then they'll find themselves on eight other websites. They basically find a patsy, and they're just sort of running down the rabbit hole trying to clear up their online reputation. Now, what I think is important to recognize is that not every arrest is warranted, not every arrest results in a conviction, not every arrest results in even charges being filed by the district attorney's office. But when these images find themselves on the internet, a person's reputation is forever tagged along with the record of this arrest, and it's hard for people to understand the subtleties of the justice system, I think, when they're Googling these images. Since I've been involved in this issue, I have also fielded a number of calls to my office from various people ranging from, I got a call a couple weeks ago from a graduate student at Portland State University, former United States Marine Corps veteran, served his country and is now looking for internships as part of his master's program. 4 years ago, he got arrested on a criminal trespass charge that was ultimately no complainant by the district attorney's office, but his image is nonetheless still on the internet, and he's aware. When you do a little bit of research when this sort of thing happens, you become aware of the issues surrounding it. And what he's afraid of is actually paying that first $100 fee. So he didn't want to pay the $100 fee because he's aware that if he does, it's probably going to have a negative effect on, rather than a positive one, because he's going to find himself in more places than he would have been otherwise. I fielded many calls from people like this. Even people of the Oregon State Bar, members of the bar, attorneys have called me who've had similar situations where they've been arrested, their images ended up on the internet, and now they're sort of forever confronted with this. And I think what HB 3467 does is it creates an avenue for a narrow class of people who have been arrested, those whose charges have been dismissed, no complaints, or gone through some kind of a diversion program, ultimately had their charges dismissed. Also, those who have had their records set aside under the expunction statute, creates an avenue for them to get these images off of the internet, which I think is an appropriate solution to this problem. So I'm in support of the bill. I ask that you would pass it. And if any questions, I'm available.
All right. Thank you. And
hello, Senator Prezansky, members of the committee. My name is Clarice Keating. I live in Southeast Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 3467. A little bit about myself. I am a reporter for the Catholic Sentinel, which is the newspaper for the Catholic Church in Western Oregon. I'm also a graduate student at Portland State University's Public Administration Program, and I'm also an active volunteer in Lentz, where Senator Dingfelder has been a very positive force. Thank you for that. So in April, I got off the MAX train and encountered three police officers investigating a 13-year-old boy for spitting on the outdoor MAX platform. So I stopped to ask a few questions about what was going on. And after I asked one of the officers for his name, he arrested me for interference with a peace officer. The following day when I went to my arraignment, I discovered that it had been dropped to a violation, and that's still in the process of being resolved. But by the next day, my mugshot and arrest details were up on the web on several sites. Last count, it was up on at least a dozen sites, and every time I search my name, it seems like there are one or two more sites where it appears. An important part of my job is interviewing sources. Every time I call somebody and ask them to let me come to their home or meet them for an interview at a coffee shop, if they're anything like me and probably you, the first thing they do is Google my name to be sure I'm who I say I am and that I'm a legitimate reporter. So I'm acutely aware of what is showing up, and that's my mugshot. And if you would please just maybe imagine for a moment what kind of impression that would make for you if you saw that. So I worry that having this information out there could impede future job opportunities or opportunities for fellowships or grants or other chances to serve my community in a positive way. I'm also have been a reporter for more than 10 years, and so I know that some media outlets have concern that this could decrease access to public records, but I can say confidently that media outlets have been able to access mugshots and arrest details long before it became common practice for law enforcement agencies to post all arrests online. So. Thank you once again for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Let me see if there are any questions. Senator Roblin first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, as I've read through the bill, I understand what it does. It puts it with a number of other things that are listed as unlawful acts. Does that give you the right then to sue them? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what
private
actually
right
has
it,
a private right of action. Is that what it does? Because
mm-hmm.
There's no other, they don't get fined or anything if they don't take it off in 30 days. It's still up to the individual to follow through and make the case and then do a private right of action if they don't remove it after 30 days. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that's what it did.
And then one other question I had regarding that, the old tort of placing someone in a false light, is that, I'm assuming, would be another option for someone if they chose to do that? I mean, it'd be a lot more drawn out.
It would, and I think, the issues with that are the same as they are at common law. I mean, if someone's been arrested, it's not necessarily putting them in a false light. I mean, an arrest is an arrest. It exists there. The remedy for that would be limited as it is.
Yeah,
as
I think
one
that's
can
right.
analyze
it's,
it.
It's yeah. right, because the reality that you were arrested is the reality that you were arrested. So
right.
It actually doesn't place you in a false light in that sense. I did want to comment a little bit on the media's response to this bill. Originally, we've amended this bill to address some of their complaints about access issues and being concerned that they wouldn't have the information readily available when they needed it to post on, on the news or in the Oregonian about someone being arrested. This bill doesn't change anything about an arrest record or a mugshot being a public record. So it's still available as a public record. The issue is whether or not a private company has the ability to post this information and to profit off removing it.
And I would add to that, it does, the language of the bill does target just those websites that charge a fee for removal. So any website that wouldn't charge a fee for removal certainly wouldn't be subject to this unlawful trade practice. I did want to comment also on just generally just the way that the internet is truly a game changer for individuals who have these things online. And I think what it does is this practice runs counter to the idea that we have a justice system that's going to deal with criminal charges in a certain way. With the practice of publishing these images on the internet, we're essentially creating a lifetime stigma associated with any arrest. And I think that the criminal justice system, where it be to go through the checks of the district attorney's office for prosecutorial discretion to make the decision to not complain a charge, or the acquittal process after a trial where a jury has decided that a person is not guilty, or the situation where the legislature has carved out narrow circumstances where a person can go through a diversion program and actually clear their name, the reality of these mugshots runs counter to all of that. It also runs counter to the statute to expunge or set aside a conviction, because really what the state has done there in another narrow class of circumstances is say, we're going to allow someone, even if they have been convicted, to seal the record of that arrest and to start over again. It's virtually impossible to do that with the presence of these mugshots online. The original version of 3467 sought to prevent the publication from local law enforcement agencies altogether of automatically and indiscriminately sort of publishing these images on the internet. If you look at a county by county or state by state or city by city, or not state by state, but city by city basis, local law enforcement agencies sort of do this differently. In Washington County, for example, they do have a web internet access to who is in custody, and they also have an ability for reporters or anyone to go down and fill out a public records request and get a copy of a person's mugshot or booking photo. But they aren't just made indiscriminately available on the internet. Individuals who've been arrested in Washington County aren't confronted with the same problems at all that individuals arrested in Portland, for example, or other jurisdictions are, because the process that local law enforcement agencies take at their discretion impacts the availability of these images and the ease for which these website companies can get the images.
Okay.
I
think we got the message.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this. I was just thinking back to a point in time when I was on a jury panel, and as they were interviewing prospective jurors, one of the questions was, what do you think about the fact that this person was arrested? And the response from this individual was, well, I figure if they're arrested, they must have done something. Okay? And you know, so there is...
Question.
I mean, there is that, yeah, that person was excused from the jury, but that is kind of the public perception, and I think this goes a long way to helping with that, so thank you for bringing this.
So, yeah, and that's a great way to get excused from the jury.
We usually run through a couple more questions just to see if they really mean that. Senator Roblin.
The internet is so strange, and once things are on there, you never really get them off. So my concern is, so a newspaper does an article and they show a mugshot. So they could call and say, could you take that off? And they say, well, okay. So they have to go back to their archives and take it out of that article? I mean, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
No. Well, it's just for these.
Yeah, and that's the distinction, I guess, between companies that charge a fee for removal. So that's the first subsection of the bill actually only applies to those who would charge a fee for removal. And you're not going to be able to prevent the internet from publishing public information, but you can at least create a remedy for some narrow class of individuals.
So, follow up. So those groups that are out there doing this, because you see these little magazines all over now, they can continue to do it as long as they don't charge to take it off?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Something I don't like about that either.
So, based on what Ryan said, I think this is going to be one of those ongoing discussions as we continue through the sessions. And regarding my comment on the false light, I agree that if you're arrested, that it doesn't put you in false light, but you also can have your arrest record expunged through a process. So there you could have it, or if they said that you were convicted when you weren't convicted, then you'd have those others. So, all right, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
No other questions for this panel. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify today on 3467A? Not seeing anyone coming forward, just observing from the back. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Get ready to go. Open work session on House Bill 3467A. Senator Dingfelder.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3467A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 3467A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, I think I'll let you carry this one just because you were made reference in there, and you probably want to clear your name.
Yes.
So, close the House Bill.
No comment on that one, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
The work session on House Bill 3467A. All right, and we'll just start up here. All right, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 21. Let's see here. I think we're going to do 2601A. Sorry.
This is the photo theme here.
Yeah, we've got a number of witnesses. I'm going to go ahead and go get into those.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2601A allows use of red light photo camera pictures in criminal judicial proceedings other than failure to obey traffic control device prosecutions, excluding other violations. There is an amendment that was gotten on this bill that would allow red light photos to be used to prosecute using a cellular device while driving prosecutions.
Okay. Kevin, you're here. It looks like you have Captain Williams, and then Gail is also scheduled to give testimony as well. Gail, why don't you go ahead and come on up, because I'm going to open up the next one that you're the sole witness on after this. Kevin?
Great. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, here to speak in favor of House Bill 2601. As you know, our association has been in favor of the use of these type of technologies in strategic ways over the years where it makes sense. And obviously, red light cameras at intersections is one of those where it's very difficult for traditional law enforcement to actually address people running the red light without creating potential hazards themselves. And so the red light does provide an opportunity to address that kind of enforcement well. And obviously, it's resulted in the reduction of red light running. So it's a great technology in that regard. Obviously, in Oregon, we have one of the lowest officer per 1,000 rates in the nation. I think we were a 50th in the last Criminal Justice Commission report. So those law enforcement resources, the actual officers, really need to be applied where they are needed the most to resolve domestic disputes and other criminal activity. This particular bill now narrowly allows the use of a photo that is taken when someone runs a red light. So someone has to run the red light, has to have committed that crime. And that photo can be used, based on this bill, in very limited circumstances in the event that they have committed another crime. It's probably ironic and no surprise that someone who's committed a crime, a burglary, is, has abducted somebody, or any number of crimes where someone's trying to get away, tend to ignore the red light at that time and run it. So in limited circumstances, and Captain Jeff Williams will talk about how this may be used in some specific examples, we're not trying to create a broad opportunity here, but a narrow one, to use those in a criminal prosecution where it can establish place and time of someone who is who's committed a crime and is now leaving the scene. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll turn it over to Captain Jeff Williams from the Beaverton Police Department.
Thank you, Captain.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Williams. I'm a captain with the City of Beaverton Police Department. It's 4755 Griffith Drive in Beaverton. Thank you for the time and opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2601. This came to my attention several months ago when there was an armed robbery occurred in the city of Newburgh in Yamhill County, not too terribly far away from the city of Sherwood in Washington County. The question was posed while the investigation was being conducted in Newburgh of whether or not a photo red light enforcement location in the city of Sherwood may have captured evidence of this armed robbery in Newburgh. At that time, the chief of Sherwood then posed the question to our chief in the city of Beaverton, since both jurisdictions currently have the photo red light enforcement. And that was the impetus by which this bill was initiated, because in its present state, we don't have the authority to use those photographs as evidence in these serious felony crimes. In Seattle, Washington, in April 2012, there was a murder in which, in that case, there was evidence that may have been available captured on photo red light, but in a similar circumstance, it wasn't legally available to the investigators to help identify the suspects in that case. In my own jurisdiction of Beaverton, we know of at least one case where we've had a stolen vehicle that the vehicle and the person operating the vehicle was captured on photo red light, but as the statute currently stands, that was not evidence available to us. As peace officers, we obviously fundamentally serve our communities to make them safe. And whether or not that's in Eugene, Roseburg, Coos Bay, Albany, Portland, or Beaverton, these crimes know no jurisdictional boundaries. And you can see how one thing starts in a community that does not have photo red light, but evidence may be available in another community. And we can't imagine the potential circumstance where we have a serious felony case, maybe an Amber Alert situation, kidnapping, stolen vehicle, attempted murders, and there could potentially be evidence out there on these photo red light systems that were precluded from using. These images, if this bill is to pass, are still subject to the same level of judicial scrutiny as all other evidence, and it's going to be used in a very, as Kevin spoke to, a very narrow circumstance, not for violations, but for these serious crimes. Anyway, we support the passage of this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
And Chair Przanski, one additional thing. I know there's an amendment that's been forwarded. For the record, that is not an amendment we've introduced to expand it. Our goal was to narrowly craft something that would work in these criminal cases. Obviously, the big question is, if you're on your cell phone and you run a red light, is that picture going to be available for some kind of subsequent prosecution? That is not our goal. And we worked with the ACLU on the House side to narrow the bill to ensure that it did not become a tool for use in those situations.
All right, thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we would like to urge a cautionary stance on behalf of the committee before proceeding further with this bill. There's no question but that government-operated photo surveillance of civilians is an effective tool to monitor the activities of the civilians and at times possibly also be used as evidence in a criminal prosecution. But the question really is, how expansively do you want that photo surveillance to go? That's really the question here. When this bill, the statute, was first enacted allowing for photo red light, there was clearly a concern of the legislature as to its breadth and expansive use, and it required a public information campaign to inform local drivers about the use of the cameras. It required each biennium for the local public entity to conduct a process and outcome evaluation and to submit a report to the Legislative Assembly. There is one here, but I don't know who's reading them. I don't know who's really looking at them. I don't know who's really taking a look at the big picture. By logic, having a camera, government-operated camera everywhere would be an effective law enforcement tool. The question really is, how far do you go? So we think that there's a huge public policy implication debate here behind the statute. There will always be an incremental next step that sounds very logical. There's an amendment right now in front of the committee. Well, let's just not limit it to criminal prosecutions. Let's also expand it for other violations. There will always be another suggestion and opportunity to use this in a bigger way, and we would urge caution before the committee proceeds.
All right, thank you. Questions? So let me just throw out there, if you had a private security camera catching people at different intersections and stuff like that, that would be admissible at least to present to a court as to relevance and for potential admittance as to time, place, and manner. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, yes. And quite frankly, if there's street fights, the first thing law enforcement will do is look around and see who's got a private camera on their property.
Okay. And so at this point, the issue is, we as a policymaker, what do we want to do as to whether we want these other cameras that are positioned wherever they are could actually show and document a track or a defendant or suspect going through and being in time, place, manner as to wherever a more serious crime is. All right.
Chair Przanski, if I might also say, I think that the committee might want to distinguish between using the camera for the purposes of investigation versus using the photo as evidence. This statute addresses its inadmissibility as evidence in court of law. Obviously, law enforcement would be able to use it for any investigative leads that it might contain for them.
And Chair Przanski, she mentioned the word surveillance, and of course, that would be a concern. The only photos available, according to this bill, would be only available if someone actually committed the crime of running the red light. The red light camera does not take pictures of people randomly driving through the intersection. So this would only come into play when someone actually has triggered the camera because they have violated or run through the red light itself. And so I just wanted to clarify, it's pretty narrow. And of course, on all of these new technologies that I know you're going to be dealing with, you're dealing with it now with the drone issue. Every session, this committee will be dealing with some technology. And I think it's appropriate that this body is continuing to discern what makes sense and what doesn't. And we're hopeful that today you would support House Bill 2601.
All right, and I just checked with counsel. I just want to make sure. So basically, the way the bill is established, it could be used for any crime in the sense of any felony or any misdemeanor prosecution?
Yes, Chair Przanski, that's correct as it's written. It would exclude other violations, so you know, non-arrestable offenses other than ORS 811-265, which is the fail to obey traffic control device, the red light statute.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2601A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And we're not going to do a work session on this one. I think I'm going to talk to Kevin Campbell regarding the current state of the bill. And we will go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2116A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2116A exempts defendants in diversion for a DUII from having to operate a motor vehicle with an ignition interlock device where they have a valid medical reason why they cannot do so, exempts defendants in diversion from having to use an ignition interlock device while operating an employer's vehicle while in the scope of their employment after following the appropriate procedures.
Gail?
Donsky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is our bill. We proffered this first through a work group that had been convened over the interim, hosted really by Representative Jim Thompson, and it had the input of many at the table. What this does is it relates to the ignition interlock device requirement under the DUI diversion statute. And it incorporates some exemptions to that requirement that are existing under the conviction side and allows those exemptions to be recognized on the diversion side. So if I can separate out conviction population from diversion population, generally the first time someone's arrested for a DUI, they're eligible for the diversion program. People who have been arrested a second time for DUI have to get convicted. They're not eligible. And some people are never eligible for diversion. It could be CDLs, commercial driver's license holders. The people under conviction obligations have to have an ignition interlock device requirement, but there are two exemptions that are recognized under the conviction side. One is a medical exemption. These are people who have a medical, usually a pulmonary condition, but it could be other, that simply cannot sustain the in-breath and outflow of the requirements of the machine. The other exemption is the employer-owned vehicle exemption. These are people who drive their own car to work, get in an employer's vehicle, like a UPS truck, at the end of their shift, they get back into their own car. And on the conviction side, the employer-owned vehicle exemption will allow the employer to be the gatekeeper as to whether or not they will say, I know this person has an ignition interlock device requirement, but when they're operating my vehicle on business use, they don't need to have one. In 2011, the legislature required ignition interlock devices for all people in diversions. But what happened in 2011 is we forgot to incorporate the exemptions. So now you have a blanket requirement in the diversion population, even for people who medically cannot operate the machine, and even for people who do operate an employer-owned vehicle. And so all this bill does is a little technical cleanup fix. It recognizes the two exemptions on the conviction side that are eligible for the diversion side. And it's under the eligibility is the same terms and conditions. It incorporates the rule requirements. And it also requires the driver to have their exemption authorization physically on them while they're driving, so that if an officer were to stop them, the officer would see the exemption authorization. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. First, Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, Gail. Question I have then, is there an alternative for folks that get the exemption? I mean, do they have to check in on a more regular basis I'm assuming you're under a DUII program.
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder, with respect to the employer, there is no requirement on the face of the bill for additional enhanced supervision of these people. For individuals with the employer-owned vehicle exemption, do know that they need to have the ignition interlock device on their personal car. So when they're driving to the grocery store, they need to have the device on. When they're driving their car to get to work, they have to have the ignition interlock device in their car. It's when they simply get into their employer-owned vehicle, the employer can say, I know you have this requirement, but I'm not going to insist that you have that on my car, because it costs to install the device in the vehicle, and so the cost really is incurred by the employer. But then when they get done with work, get back into their own car, then they have to have their ignition interlock device again. So as to the employer-owned vehicle exemption, it's only in effect when they're driving their employer-owned vehicle car for business. As to the medical exemption, there's no requirement on the conviction side necessarily for enhanced supervision of those people. I think it's simply a recognition that sometimes people have certain conditions and they can't comply with the rigor and the requirement of the testing procedure.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yep.
I understand that. I mean, I certainly could envision somebody who has an oxygen tank, for instance, who can't do that. However, I guess in my mind I would like to see some alternative to make sure that they're following their DUII program. And I understand it's not in this bill. I'm just, maybe I'll just make a call to judge who works on this and ask what her opinion is.
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder, our intent was to simply create parity in the exemptions on both sides. So it being recognized on the conviction side, those folks are supervised by probation officers. And similarly, there's no probation officer, so to speak, on a diversion, but there is a treatment provider. And they do have a requirement that they not consume alcohol during the entirety of the diversion program. So if there were aberrant behavior outside what's tolerated under the diversion program, that would come to the attention of a judge, we would hope.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Just an interesting question because it popped up. So if a person's on a diversion program and they do have an interlock device for their own vehicle, if they rent a car?
Chair Przanski, Senator Roebling, there's no exemption for rental cars. And so basically the diversion, the IID requirement, the ignition interlock device requirement, basically says any car in which you operate, you need to have one.
It goes with the person.
So can your device go with the person?
Mm-hmm.
Nope. No.
No, that's what I thought. It has to be installed.
Installed in the vehicle.
So basically, is there anything on the driver's license that should indicate to a person renting them a car that they are in that agreement?
Probably not.
Chair Przanski, Senator Roebling, I don't believe
not.
So.
Yeah.
I would assume not, too. So they could probably go rent a car and no one would know.
Well, or they could drive theirs or drive another person's car, too.
That's true. That's true. Okay.
That's true. Thanks. All right, any other questions or comments? All right, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2116A? Not seeing them, we'll close the public hearing. Open up a work session on House Bill 2116A. Senator Dingfelder.
I move House Bill 2116A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2116A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 2116A. And we're going to go ahead and close the work session on 2116A. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 3253A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3253A requires persons convicted of crimes in a court of the United States that required sex offender registration to register in Oregon, even if the crime they were convicted of does not require registration in Oregon, pertains to federal convictions, applies only to crimes committed after passage of this act.
All right, so I'm looking at the registration sheet and I see Jeffrey Kent and Janet Arnez are two that have checked the form four box with Janet being as amended. I have someone with a written statement as against. Then I got three with neutral. So we've got a hodgepodge of people. So why don't we go ahead and bring those who think they're in favor of the bill, Jeffrey Kent and Janet Arnez. Why don't y'all two come up first?
Thank you.
Morning, Jeff. How are you doing?
Morning.
Good to see you up here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Kent. I retired as a federal prosecutor some 6 years ago after 30-plus years in prosecutions in Chicago and in Eugene, Oregon. A number of those years were spent working on child pornography cases. And what I found in those cases was it was absolutely critical that reasonable prosecutorial discretion be exercised so that we weren't using our resources to prosecute the so-called curious and somehow missing the predatory pedophiles, which were the main objective of the statute. In fact, some 20-plus years ago, I testified here in Salem in support of a bill to criminalize the very possession of child pornography. At that time, the People versus Henry decision created some fog on whether or not possession of child pornography fell under the ruling, which was an obscenity-based decision. I also wrote a law review article in the University of Oregon Law Review in support of that bill. I had a reputation as a tough, hard-charging prosecutor. The supervisor of our office used to describe me as a tough draw for defense attorneys. So I find it somewhat ironic that I'm here asking the legislature to take a hard look at the sexual offender registry. And I know this particular bill is focused upon juveniles, and particularly very young juveniles, as to whether or not it's appropriate that they, in effect, end up with what is a scarlet letter, really a lifetime tattoo for most people who are required to register, which affects their ability to find housing, find employment, and places many other burdens upon them. The thing that piqued my personal interest in this was the case of a son of a friend who was prosecuted as a camp counselor as a 19-year-old for having sex with a mature 15-year-old in Minnesota. He ended up serving 6 months in a Minnesota jail and is now required in Oregon to be a lifetime registrant on the sexual offender registry. I view my testimony as actually pro-law enforcement as opposed to pro, in quotes, defense. In this respect, just as it was important in child pornography prosecutions to use superb discretion to make sure we were going after the predatory pedophiles, it's my opinion, based upon what I've read, that the Oregon registry is far too broad in what it covers. And I found it interesting that a prior witness here for the state police, and I believe it was the red light issue, indicated the importance of being able to dedicate resources to other locations, particularly, as I would note in this body is well aware of it, scarce resources in tough budgetary times everywhere. And this particular young man, who was the son of a friend of mine, I couldn't believe the number of hours, I would say at least scores and maybe hundreds of hours, that were dedicated by probationary services to monitor intensely this kid who was involved in what was essentially, in quotes, a statutory rape, in which if people were to be perfectly honest, many would say, there but for the grace of God, with young hormonal urges, goes I. But this young man is now left with the proverbial scarlet letter for the rest of his life. This bill, I know, focuses upon very young juveniles. As sad as the case of this individual is, who was a young adult, the cases of these very young juveniles, many of whom were involved in sexual indiscretions, possibly worse, and I understand that Measure 11 offenses are exempt from what is being proposed here, end up with a lifetime registration requirement. I know that it's a big request to ask a legislature to carve back a criminal statute, or at least a collateral criminal statute. But I would urge this committee to really take a good hard look at the sexual registry, just as was true in the child pornography possession cases. Who we're really worried about should be the serial rapists, the predatory pedophiles, and other serious sexual assailants. But so much of the resources are diverted. And I think about the J.C. Dugard case down in California, where this young lady was kidnapped as a 10-year-old student by a person who had a significant sexual offense history. I happened to be in Lake Tahoe at the time that she was found. I think it was some 13, 14 years later. And unfortunately, the California Probation Office never went into the backyard and never found the young lady, who's since been reunited with her family as a virtual stranger. Let's use the resources wisely. Let's focus on the truly dangerous people, who, in my assessment, are the predatory pedophiles, the serial rapists, and the sexual repetitive sexual assailants. Thank you.
Thanks. Jan?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. If I might ask that you invite Mark McKechnie to come up and testify, he can frame up the amendments on the bill and give you more detailed information on its intent. And I do have some testimony I'd like to follow, if I may.
All right, that's fine. But before we do that, let me just see if there's any questions for Mr. Kent. Jeff, thank you very much for being here. I'm going to let you step back. We're going to have some other people come forward. Okay. Appreciate it. And also just want to acknowledge Jeff is a neighbor and someone that actually did work in the U.S. Attorney's Office and was very, good at his work and actually held a lot of people that were involved in timber theft accountable. So thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mark, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and then I think, Scott, I'm going to go ahead and let you come up and take the other chair, since we're going to be talking about the amendments. I think we now have everyone that's talked about amendments.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm providing public defense services in the juvenile court system. We've represented 50,000 children, youth, and parents since 1975. Appreciate the opportunity to explain the amendments because they are substantially different than the underlying bill, which we're not here to comment on today. So I want to direct your attention to the dash 4 and dash 5 amendments. That's the focus of my testimony and several others today. The dash 5 amendments address essentially a couple of technical issues that follow on Senate Bill 408, which was passed overwhelmingly last session, relating to the ability of juveniles to petition for relief to get off the registry. And we discovered after that bill was passed that there were a couple groups that sort of fell into this this gray area, where I think the intent was to allow people like them to get relief, but because of their particular circumstances, they were not able to petition. One group is individuals who were adjudicated as juveniles in Oregon and then moved to another state, and often the requirement to register follows them to the other state. So it is important for them to be able to petition for relief when they're eligible in the state of Oregon, to be relieved of that underlying requirement for relief, and then many states will then recognize that that requirement has been lifted and that will affect their status in their new state as well. The current language in the relief statute only applies to individuals who are required to register in Oregon because they're living, attending school, or working in Oregon. And if you're not present physically in Oregon, basically the statute doesn't allow you to apply for relief. We would like to fix that, and it was fixed in the adult statute a few sessions ago. The other category of individuals includes persons who committed an offense when they were juveniles, a non-Measure 11 offense that was not reported to law enforcement until the individual was over the age of 18, and that means jurisdiction then can only be the prosecution and conviction can only occur in adult court, and that places the individual under the adult relief provisions, which are much more narrow than the juvenile statute. And we would simply like to add a provision that someone who committed an act when they were younger than 18, a non-Measure 11 offense only, who was then prosecuted later in the adult court, could petition for relief under all of the other adult requirements, except that it would allow for an A or B felony offense to be relieved, and adult relief is limited to C felonies and misdemeanors. So that's the dash 5 amendments. The dash 4 amendments are also sort of inspired by what Senate Bill 408 did and did not do. Younger juveniles are more likely, by virtue of their age, to be charged with higher level offenses because of the age of both the accused and the alleged victim. Often when children act out, they do it with peers that are similar in age. So a juvenile who is under the age of 15, it's likely that the person that they engaged in the conduct with or the victim was also under 15, and that is typically at least a Class B felony. We would like to remove the registration requirement up front for juveniles who are under 15 at the time of the offense, or under 14 if it's a offense that involved force or incapacitation. The reason we're putting this forward is for some of the reasons mentioned already, that our registry is very expansive. It's one of the most expansive in the country. It's one of the few that automatically imposes lifetime registration up front for juveniles based on their adjudication. There are provisions to get relief that were improved under Senate Bill 408, but the presumption is that juveniles have to register first and then try to get relief later. This is a very heavy and, we believe, unreasonable burden on very young juveniles who, frankly, are engaged many times in relatively normal impulsive behavior, don't fully understand the consequences of their behavior, and are exploring and make mistakes that they do not grow up to repeat. The recidivism rates for juveniles across the board for both minor and serious offenses is very low. The range in the literature is between 1%, typically, and 12%. And you find many studies coming in at between 4 and 7%. The official recidivism rate reported by the Oregon Youth Authority for youth who leave their custody is 4%. I provided some information to you on a study in Wisconsin that looked at all offenders across the state for a time period, all juvenile offenders for sex offenses and non-sex offenses. And when they looked 5 years down the road at arrests for the entire population, there was no statistically significant difference in the chances that those youth who are registered versus those youth who did not have to register because they had not committed a previous sex offense. There was no statistical significant difference in their chances that they would offend. It was very low for both groups. It was 6% for one, 7% for the other. The other important fact is that the registry does not predict who is likely to commit these offenses in the future. New York State found that 95% of offenses in a given year are committed by people who are not registered. They don't have previous records. They hadn't been caught before. So simply knowing somebody who had committed one of these offenses in the past does very little to help law enforcement try to prevent future offenses. And in fact, in the Wisconsin study, when they looked at juveniles who had some kind of law violation in their history, who then committed offenses in the future, again, the numbers were very low. But of the offenses committed, only 14% were committed by those who were required to register versus 86% who did not have a prior history of that type of offense and therefore were not required to register. I just want to also draw your attention to, unfortunately, one of my charts sort of blew up on the printer. That's the Wisconsin study. Apparently this information was too big to be contained by one page. But there is another chart that printed correctly that shows you how for similar behavior, younger youth would be charged with a more serious offense than an older youth. So if a junior engages, basically has unwanted contact with a sophomore student, it would likely, not involving force, it would likely be charged as sex abuse 3, which is a Class A misdemeanor and not registrable, versus an eighth grader who has unwanted contact with a seventh grader, again, not forcible. That, by virtue of the age of the victim, is a Class B felony and subject to automatic registration up front. So the reason why we are putting forward this concept of a minimum age is partly because of this dynamic where the age of the victim drives the severity of the offense, even in non-forcible offenses. And these are the most teachable, the most changeable kids. They're young, they can go through treatment, they can be held accountable, and the statistics show that they're very unlikely to continue with these behaviors later. And as you heard in the mugshot debate, once information gets out into the public, it's very hard to erase that record. So even a juvenile who had to register for a few years, who gets relief, in the age of the internet, it's hard to erase that history once it's there. So even obtaining relief doesn't have the same effect that it used to before all of this information was available on the internet. So other people have similar things to say and can add to some of these points. I'm going to stop here, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
All right. Janet?
Thank you, Chair Prozanski and committee members. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We are a statewide nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits who take care of children. We represent about $205 million in services and serve over 100,000 children each year. Many of my members, those programs and organizations represent everything from mentoring programs to psychiatric residential facilities, and of course, all along that continuum is included juvenile justice youth as well. You've got some comments in front of you that I've put in writing. I just want to tell a couple of brief stories that highlight some of the comments that Mark just made about the impact of the bill. One of our members, Janice Youth Programs from Portland, has a long time sex offender program and had intended on being here to be able to testify for you today. And while I can't bring you the entire testimony, I would like to mention a couple of recidivism facts from their program so you have a little bit of an understanding of the comments that Mark was making on this. That they treat both much younger youth who have engaged in these inappropriate activities, and they also have treatment programs for older youth. The recidivism rate for the younger youth in throughout the history of their program is 0%. The older youth often have already invested somewhere between 5 and 7 years between time in closed custody, time in community treatment programs, and then, of course, whatever accountability requirements need to be met. And that's a pretty big investment for a young person. And so to get through a fairly rigorous ordeal, including the responsibilities and accountability and treatment, the recidivism rate for the 57 youth, older youth that they had in their program resulted in 2 individuals who recidivated in a sex offense area. So there's very, very good treatment and community service opportunities for these youth. In terms of the impact on youth when they're trying to do the right thing, you know, graduate from school, get a job, get stable housing, transition into adulthood, Youth Progress Association, another one of my members, also has a sex offender program, and they had a youngster who was was staying in school and who got a job at a part-time job at Fred Meyer as a bag boy and had a couple of roommates, and the store found out that he was registered as a sex offender and fired him. And it wasn't very long after that that his roommates found out why he was fired, didn't want him as a roommate anymore, and then all of his classmates knew about it. So here's a young man who's made a big investment in, or a youngster who's made a big investment in trying to do the right thing and be exactly the kind of youngster and burgeoning adult that we would want, who's suffered significantly under the bill despite all of his best efforts, or under the current law. So I hope that information is helpful to you. I'm available for questions.
All right. Thank you. Scott?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Scott Healy, and I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I just thought I'd give the committee, a little bit of the history of these issues. This was originally proposed as House Bill 2552 on the other side, and House Bill 2552 died over there on the other side, and now these amendments have been brought and attached to House Bill 3253 because it has the proper relating clause, even though it doesn't really have anything to do with the bill originally. So I'm trying to come back up to speed. I dealt with 2552 on the other side, trying to come back up to speed on these issues again here kind of a little bit late. The Oregon District Attorneys Association has issues with, you know, how far the bill goes. We don't feel that it goes far enough. I've had some significant conversations actually with Mr. McKechnie, and it's not that we can't have this conversation and that maybe there couldn't be something done with regard to these issues. But there's a competency statute, for instance, that, you know, if we're going to prosecute adults for any conduct that they engage in, maybe as juveniles, because the statute of limitations allows us to, we're only allowed to prosecute people that are 12 years of age or older because of competency issues. And so I've always sort of suggested that, you know, age 12 is probably the age where we should start having sex offenders register, and Mr. McKechnie and I have talked about that. This contemplates 15 for nonviolent offenders and 14 for violent offenders, just to give you an idea of what they're talking about right now. The reason that I say that we're concerned about the fact that it doesn't go far enough is, and I'm not going to tell you stories. I was a child sex abuse prosecutor for 14 years. I ended doing that about 3.5 years ago. And so I could, of course, sit here and tell you horror stories. I don't want to do that. You know, you don't need to have that information in your brain. But suffice it to say that I could talk to you about 12-year-old offenders, 13-year-old offenders, and 14-year-old offenders that have been have done some very horrific things with regard to child sexual abuse. And we feel that those people do, you know, those people need to register and they need to be monitored. Now, one other thing I wanted to point out, though, is that I believe our association worked with Youth Rights and Justice and Mr. McKechnie and others, I think it was last term. Currently, as the law currently states, under subsection 2 A and B, juveniles that have been convicted of A and B felony sex crimes do have the right to petition to get off registration 2 years after they are, 2 years after the termination of the court's jurisdiction on A and B felony sex crimes, and on C felony sex crimes, 30 days after the termination of the jurisdiction over that person. And that's a relatively new law. And so I don't know that we know exactly what the court is doing with those, but I want the committee to understand that there is an avenue for these individuals who do have to register and have been convicted as juveniles to get off the registration before they can become adults, or in some cases, you know, while they're still juveniles. And so that safety valve is already there for them, and that is something that we worked with in the past. So having said that, I think that you know, we maybe need to keep the conversation going, but for obvious reasons in terms of public safety and the safety of victims, we believe that these amendments don't go far enough, and we would like to continue to work on it and then hopefully bring something back to the committee that maybe we're all in agreement with and which might be best for everyone involved. Thank you, Chair Przanski.
Thank you. Questions? No questions. Thank you for all. Mark, there's one question. When you're going through your example of the on your handout, when the only difference is age, and I thought I heard you say on the comparison on the 7th and 8th grader that the 14-year-old having unwanted contact with the 13-year-old could likely be charged with sex abuse 1. But there's also still the 3-year age defense in that case that more than likely would apply as if they were going to charge him with rape.
Senator Przanski, I believe the key word there is unwanted. I do believe if the 13-year-old agreed that the contact was consensual, then the person could assert the 3-year age defense. But if it were something that was not invited, then that defense would not.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Any other comments? Thank you very much. Our next panel is by Beatty and Debbie Martin.
Good morning, Senator Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Martin. I'm a parole and probation supervisor for the Oregon Youth Authority in Lane County. Excuse me. I worked as a juvenile probation officer for 15 years, with 10 of those years working on a sex offense-specific caseload, and I've spent 3 years with the Oregon Youth Authority as the sex offense treatment coordinator. I was requested by Youth Rights and Justice to provide information about sex offense registration in juveniles. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide information to the committee on a subject matter that I've been professionally dedicated to for 15 years. Over the past several years, I've monitored research in the area of sex offense registration policies. While the research is sparse, none of the studies have found that sex offense registration for juveniles impacts community safety or reduces recidivism.
The research also indicates that there is no general deterrence impact or the potential to avert first-time offenders with juvenile sex offense registration. Some of the concerns noted in the research indicate that sex offense registration may serve to socially isolate youth by increasing difficulty in finding employment, decreasing involvement in educational or vocational programming, and increasing a fear of harassment. Social isolation, lower education and vocational records, and lower employment rates actually serve to increase a youth's risk for recidivism. In addition, adolescent development is a significant period of identity formation. A youth is working to define themselves and what their role is in the context of family, peers, and their community. When labeling theory or the idea that a descriptor or a category assigned to a youth, particularly regarding deviancy or anything that puts them outside the norm, is considered here as well, it can have negative impacts on their normal development. I thank you for the opportunity to make these brief statements and provide information to the committee. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thanks, Debbie. Bye.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Sex Offender Registry for Oregon State Police. I'm going to do a little bit different testimony here. I'd like to clarify what the 3253A actually does all by itself. First and foremost, the thing to remember is that in 1995, Oregon adopted language that states if a person moves to Oregon and is required to register in their state of conviction, they have to register in Oregon. So that law has been in place since 1995. We've also had compact language that says if you compact to Oregon under supervision and you're required to register in your state of conviction, then you must register in the state of Oregon as well. So those particular laws have been in play for quite some time. We also consider persons who transfer from one correctional facility into an Oregon correctional facility. We call that moving into Oregon additionally. Current language in Oregon law states that if your state of conviction requires you to register, but what it has bypassed is tribal law, territorial law, federal and military law. That's what 3253A addresses specifically. If in one of the 197 outside of Oregon independent Indian tribes who carry their own registration under federal law require an individual to register, if they move into Oregon at this time, unless we can elementally compare those crimes to one another and equate it to an Oregon sex crime, that individual does not have to register in Oregon. Additionally, if a person is court-martialed on a military base in Iraq for possession of child pornography, or if a person is federally convicted of a crime in Oregon for coercion or possession of child pornography or transporting a minor across state lines for sexual purposes, those crimes do not elementally compare to Oregon sex crimes, so those individuals currently do not have to register in Oregon. However, if a person is convicted of possession of child pornography in the state of Washington, because Washington state law requires that person to register for that federal offense and they move to Oregon, then because their state of conviction requires them to register in Oregon, they must register in Oregon. So what 3253 really does is it closes those loopholes in Oregon, and it makes a straighter playing field across the nation for the tribes, the territories, the military, the federal offenses. So that's 3253. The -A4 amendments incorporate removing juveniles from Oregon's current registry. The handout that you have is an approximation of the numbers we currently have in the registry. So for persons 14 and below who register, we have a total of 988 persons out of about 1,400 registered youth. It would take, in the two-year period outlined for this change, if it's adopted, in the two-year period, it would take four state police sex offender employees 8 hours a month to evaluate and remove those 988 persons. There's a column that says out-of-state multi-adjudication, multi-dates. There are 470 individuals identified there. Those particular cases, because juvenile records are so protected around the nation in all juvenile courts, including Oregon, we do not get judgments from Oregon courts, Oregon juvenile courts usually. That requires us to create a form and request specific information from other jurisdictions, be it a territory, a state, or a tribe. We would need to know the commission date so that we know the age of the individual when the crime was committed. We would also need to know the circumstances, was force involved for those 14-year-olds that may have to stay on there. That's going to take a little bit more time. So I've estimated 7 to 8 hours per employee additionally per month. So we're looking at 15 to 16 hours a piece for 4 SOR positions for 2 years to review, evaluate, and remove. I do apologize. I do not have statistical information on how many people have petitioned since January 1st of 2012 under Senate Bill 408 for relief for that two-year piece that went into play, but I will get those numbers put together and I'll send them to Council Schmidt and he can distribute them out. The Dash 5 amendments, which haven't really been discussed, is kind of the carve out for those individuals who as adults committed a crime as a youth and have been convicted in adult court. There are some language issues with those. Again, the commission dates would give us a little bit of issue, assuming that we can get the information so that we can go back and look at current registrants to see if those persons would have to come off. However, with youth, please remember that juvenile courts do have jurisdiction and authority to do a set-aside or vacate of a crime prior to the end of juvenile court wardship or even after juvenile court wardship. We've seen them both ways. So we have seen Class A or B felonies where the individual has not had to register for 2 years, where the court, the juvenile court, will go back and modify the crime to either harassment or some other offense that does not require registration, or they will also go back and vacate, set aside the original judgment so that the youth does not have to register from that point onward. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Bayad had one question this morning to put on the record. For a person that's coming from out of state that's going to be required to register here, that the elements of that crime in the other state doesn't meet what we have as our in our state, the length of the registration is controlled by what they would need to have done in their in the state of conviction, or does it come over and then goes into the Oregon system?
Chair Przanski, if we cannot equate a crime in Oregon, then their length of period of their length of registration is linked to their original state. So if in Washington a person has a 10-year requirement, we cannot equate the crime in Oregon. If they're relieved in Washington after 10 years, they provide us a copy of that relief, we remove them from the registry in Oregon. If the crime equates, then they fall under Oregon law.
Okay. Just want that on the record. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, mostly just, again, for the record, not questions for these people, but, you know, as a high school principal, these laws probably cause as much consternation as anything that I've ever dealt with, because we get situations that you watch and you see, and some of the most unfair for the longest duration. People who made really bad choices at the time, but did so in emotional ways, that I think the prosecutor said earlier about some of the stuff, and to have them register for life, this makes absolutely no sense. So I would love if the DAs and others could get together and make this actually work out, because I haven't seen in any of those cases that I know repeat offenses. I haven't seen other kinds of things. And so there has to be a way from my perspective, a rational society to figure out a way to not have these things affect some of these young people their entire lives, which I watch it playing out in my local communities in ways that are really destructive and really isolating. And really, it hurts me when I see this and I go back home and I've talked to parents repeatedly just trying to figure out what they can do and finding no relief, it makes no sense. So I would hope we can figure out a way to get something where people really hone in on the deals. And I really appreciated the idea about it really should be, you know, when we had those lists and whatever at the schools, we tried to go through that list and make sure we figured out which ones were the really dangerous people we didn't want to have around schools, because there's too many to keep it in your brain. So you've got to figure out who it was. And I will tell you that the other one was some of them who were dangerous. I've also found that there's a number of these that are family people, and it's the only place it took place in, and it was really a horrible crime, and they need to be there. But having the child walk in and see a poster on the floor of their parent was often very disruptive to their educational well-being. So I'm not sure what's the best solution, because I do not want these people taking advantage of kids and others, but coming up with some kind of organization, and we've done it year after year, and I've watched us trying to figure out how to do this, but I would wish we wouldn't always just get no and yes, and somehow figure out how to get to the place where we know what we're doing is the best for these people. So,
all right.
Just a comment.
We have one other person that wants to give testimony that wasn't on the list. Mr. Madison, come forward. You have a couple of minutes. We can take testimony. I have one other matter I need to take care of, and then I'm going to make some comments on this bill after Mr. Madison. Mr. Madison, it looks like you have a PowerPoint. Can you tell me how long your PowerPoint is?
It should be fairly quickly, around 5 minutes, I think. I pared it down pretty well.
No, I have 5 minutes.
Two or three minutes
to make comments as to the bill itself, and so we can get it on the record, but I've got another matter I need to take care of before my committee.
Very well, then. I'm going to skip ahead to the actual vital. There's two slides I want to show you today, and this is the fifth slide in the sequence. And this effort today is to explain who the offenders are. I think we've kind of nibbled at the edges today, and I brought some valuable things I think will help us out. These three pie charts are showing...
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, yes. Thomas Henry Madison, Gresham, Oregon. Thank you. Anyway, these three pie charts show the age ranges of victims of sex crimes. The left one, victims under 6, the middle, 7 to 11 years old, and victims 12 and 17 on the right. The unique thing about this, and keep this whole thing very short, is that if you look at the color coding of each of these pie charts, you see that family member and acquaintance make up the vast majority of those who commit crimes against children. And if you look at that tiny little gray wedge, ranging from 1.8% on the left to 5.7% on the right, that is the wedge that are the stranger sex offenders, that is, stranger to child sex offenders. Very small wedge. The next slide, I know we're out of time, is, of course, who are those sex offenders in that gray wedge? And I've got one last slide to show you. Here's that breakdown from a separate report, and I do have things I can send you to support these things in later on today, is that 94% of all sex crimes are committed by first-time offenders. That conversely, that means the 6% are those on the registry. So right there, those two or three slides I've shown you tell us that we are way out of balance, way out of, the registry itself doesn't make sense relative to the hard facts about who is committing sex crimes in our country, here in Oregon too. That needs to be looked at in part of our part of what we think about when we talk about expanding, extending, and layering more and more sex crime laws onto the basic registry. That's, in essence, my presentation.
Mr. Madison, thank you very much. Very detailed information. Any questions for Mr. Madison?
I agree.
Thank you very much for giving us the information.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3253A. And this bill, we actually have, we don't have all the paperwork, plus I know that the parties on the juvenile issues are still talking and working with each other, and so we're going to be carrying that bill over. That bill will be carried over till next Tuesday, which is May 28th. May 28th, Tuesday, for House Bill 3253A. And while I'm on it, we also will be carrying over House Bill 2601A to the same date, May 28th. So both those bills, 2601A and 3253A, will be carried over till next Tuesday, May 28th. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3277A.
Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3277A, we've heard previously, it amends 137-106, which says that the prosecuting attorney must give restitution information to the court prior to the time of sentencing. This would mean that you could do it within 90 days of sentencing. There was an amendment. OCDLA and ODA worked together on that amendment. It is the A5 before the committee, which essentially says that the prosecuting attorney must give the defense attorney notice of the evidence that they intend to present at that hearing, and they must do that 10 days ahead of the hearing. This amendment just makes clear that if they fail to meet that 10-day obligation, because let's say the victim comes in at the last minute with receipts and things that the prosecutor didn't have, the remedy is a continuance, a set over, that would not count against the 90-day timeline.
Okay.
So that's it.
All right. So we have a work session. The chair will take, will move the A5 into House Bill 3277.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Already done. I just moved it.
Oh. Okay.
Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, we now have the A5s in House Bill 3277. Senator Dinkelberg.
Yeah, I move House Bill 3277A as amended with the dash A5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 3277A as amended by the A5s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 3277A to the floor. With that, we've carried over just once again House Bill 2601 as well as House Bill 3253 to next Tuesday, which is May 28th. Is there anything else that we need to do, Andre?
We've done all the others, right?
And everything else should
everything
be checked off, is all that. And with that, we're adjourned for the day. Thank you.
So we'll try.